He was a noble Jew, Dahas remembers saying, and the remark caught Brandeis up short. What did he mean by this? And what was the man Herzl like, whom Dahas had served in his younger days? Brandeis turned the car around, urged Dahas back home for lunch and more talk. From this conversation, August 13, 1912, is traditionally dated Brandeis's quote-unquote conversion to Zionism. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 172, Brandeis and the Balfour Declaration. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. It was to mark the 250th anniversary of the arrival of Jews in North America that Louis D. Brandeis was asked to serve as a speaker at a gathering in November of 1905. Born in Louisville in 1856, attending Harvard Law School without even going to college, having built a Boston law firm known for its extraordinary impact on jurisprudence, Brandeis embodied Jewish success and assimilation in America. It is therefore unsurprising that, as Brandeis's biographer Mel Yourofsky puts it, the speech that Brandeis delivered, quote, could have been made by any upper-class assimilated Jew, end quote. Brandeis addressed the immigration of Jews from Eastern Europe to America, arguing that, quote, the new immigrants had to be taught that, quote, there is no place for what President Roosevelt has called hyphenated Americans. There is room here for men of any race, of any creed, of any condition in life, but not for Protestant Americans or Catholic Americans, not for German Americans, Irish Americans, or Russian Americans, end quote. What was left unsaid was nevertheless heard in the room that for Brandeis, those Jews arriving in America had to understand that there was no room for those taking on the hyphenated identity of Jewish Americans. Jews needed to assimilate. In rejecting hyphenated identity, Brandeis was at this moment rejecting Jewishness as Jews had long understood it. In a famous essay by Joseph Soloveitchik, pointed to the way that Abraham introduced himself to the men of Canaan, of Canaan. He said, I am a stranger and a neighbor among you, a stranger and a neighbor. The point is that Jewish identity is indeed hyphenated. Jews are obligated to serve as dedicated members of their society while still being set apart by their faith and covenantal calling. In Rabbi Soloveitchik's words, quote, we think of ourselves as human beings, sharing the destiny of Adam in his general encounter with nature and as members of a covenantal community which has preserved its identity under most unfavorable conditions. Confronted by another faith community. We believe we are summoned by God, who revealed himself at both the level of universal creation to undertake a double mission, the universal human and the exclusive covenantal confrontation, end quote. Brandeis in 1905 rejected this dialectic, and Rabbi Soloveitchik almost seems to be speaking about Brandeis's 1905 address when he further writes that, quote, the emancipated modern Jew, however, has been trying for a long time to do away with this twofold responsibility, which weighs heavily upon him. The westernized Jew maintains that it is impossible to engage in both confrontations, the universal and the covenantal, which in his opinion are mutually exclusive, end quote. 5 years later, as Yourofsky further notes, Brandeis argued for the mutual exclusivity of the two sides of a hyphenated identity, telling a reporter that, quote, habits of living or of thought which tend to keep alive differences of origin or classify men according to the religious beliefs are inconsistent with the American ideal of brotherhood and are disloyal, end quote. And yet only 4 years after this, in 1914, Brandeis's approach to Jewish identity seems to have changed. With the world at war, and Berlin no longer an appropriate headquarters for the Zionist movement, Brandeis was asked to serve as chairman of the newly founded Provisional Executive Committee for General Zionist Affairs. And in accepting and embracing the cause, Brandeis offered very different sentiments than he had previously, saying that, quote, for the Jew in America at peace in a strong, neutral country, these are momentous days pregnant with serious tasks. He will be called upon, too, to raise in large part the relief funds that will be needed to alleviate the distress and repair the losses of the millions of our people who are now groaning under the pitiless exactions of war. He will be called upon to rescue the Jews in Palestine, who have always looked to the diaspora for sustenance, and who are now overwhelmed by want and anxieties. In these respects, we urge you to do your fullest duty as Jews when the proper time is at hand. End quote. Gone was the Brandeis who had insisted that a hyphenated identity was disloyal. To be a Jew for Brandeis was to be beholden to one's people all over the world, and to be an American Jew was to feel obligated to utilize one's freedom for the good of Jews in need. It is a transformation of an American Jew that is an incredible part of the story of the Balfour Declaration and the Holy Land. Let us sketch today the basic details of this story. Melvin Yourofsky in his biography describes Brandeis's religious upbringing, and it is almost a perfect embodiment of the assimilated westernized Jew that Rabbi Soloveitchik described. Brandeis's parents, Adolf and Frederica Brandeis, predicated their lifestyle on the assumption that religious particularism interfered with one's status as a human being. It's therefore unsurprising that the child of such parents would acquire no real sense of Jewishness, and it's all the more shocking that he would suddenly embrace public Jewish identity. Brandeis said this himself in his speech to assembled Zionists in 1914, reflecting that, quote, "I feel my disqualification for this task. Throughout the long years which represent my own life, I have been to a great extent separated from Jews. I am very ignorant in things Jewish," end quote. But throughout his youth, one Jewish role model had existed for Brandeis, his mother's brother, Louis Dembitz, a learned lawyer who inspired Brandeis's own choice of career so profoundly that Louis D. Brandeis changed his own middle name from David to Dembitz in his uncle's honor. And a study of Dembitz's own life and how he was remembered reveals Louis Dembitz to be an American of profoundly hyphenated identity, a stranger and neighbor par excellence, admired by fellow Americans for his integrity and civic engagement, and also for his open dedication to his Jewish faith. He was known to be fully observant of Jewish law, and he was also a dedicated American, proud anti-slavery supporter of Abraham Lincoln. Brandeis himself, in one striking passage, recalled the impact that seeing the impact of his uncle's Sabbath observance had had on him, impressing on him the power of the Sabbath, the sanctity of the Sabbath. Thus, Louis Dembitz embodied for Brandeis the sole example that he, Brandeis, saw of Jewish observance. Louis Dembitz was therefore clearly far from Brandeis's mind when Brandeis spoke in 1905 against hyphenated identity. Then came 1912, when Brandeis's Cape Cod vacation home was visited by the journalist Jacob DeHaas, the editor of the Boston Jewish Advocate. DeHaas was a dedicated Zionist who had served as secretary to Theodore Herzl. He had come to interview Brandeis, however, about something utterly unrelated, matters of law. Following the interview, Brandeis drove DeHaas back to the train, and while they conversed, DeHaas asked whether he, Brandeis, was related to Louis Dembitz, explaining that Dembitz was a dedicated Zionist. Something seems to have awoken within Brandeis. The writer Peter Gross summarizes this moment. Quote, "He was a noble Jew," DeHaas remembers saying, and the remark caught Brandeis up short. What did he mean by this? And what was the man Herzl like, whom DeHaas had served in his younger days? Brandeis turned the car around, urged DeHaas back home for lunch and more talk. From this conversation, August 13, 1912, is traditionally dated Brandeis's quote-unquote conversion to Zionism, end quote. Thus did this reference to Louis Dembitz as a noble Jew by Jacob DeHaas inspire the transformation of Brandeis's own public persona as a Jew. Let us fast forward to May of 1917, when Washington, D.C. was visited by Arthur Balfour, the new British foreign minister. As we discussed yesterday, the cabinet of Lloyd George in London had been discussing the role that a future conquest of the Holy Land by Britain might play in the Zionist future. Balfour sought to know whether Wilson, the president, who had appointed Brandeis to the United States Supreme Court, would support a future Jewish home in the Holy Land, and he therefore sought out the most prominent of American Jews and the most prominent of Zionists in America, a Supreme Court justice, to learn more. Following an initial meeting, Brandeis made his way to the White House for a chat with the president. And, as Peter Gross describes, upon a second meeting with Balfour, quote, Brandeis was able to promise Wilson's wholehearted support, including his readiness to speak out in public at the appropriate time, end quote. Balfour returned to London, reflecting that Brandeis, quote, was probably the most remarkable man, end quote, that he had encountered on the trip. As Gross further writes, we have to realize how striking this series of events actually is. Gross writes, quote, as an illustration of back-channel diplomacy at its most effective, the Balfour-Brandeis encounter was exceptional. A foreign minister, seeking understanding on a delicate political issue, turned not to his official opposite number, the Secretary of State, or even to the other foreign policy advisors known to be close to the president. He sought out instead a member of the judiciary, having neither official nor unofficial standing in the matter, but a deep personal interest and the sympathetic ear of the president. Brandeis, for his part, saw no impropriety in discussing a humane, philanthropic issue, end quote. Brandeis's assurance of support to Balfour could not have come at a more important time, for as Rick Richmond points out in a fascinating essay, it was Brandeis's lobbying that helped offset the lobbying of Edwin Montague against Zionist efforts. In the face of Montague's anti-Zionist lobbying, Chaim Weizmann, as Richmond reports, turned to Brandeis, and Brandeis, Richmond further writes, quote, wired Weizmann that based on his talks with Wilson, the president was in quote-unquote entire sympathy with the draft declaration, and in mid-October, Wilson himself passed a private message to the British supporting the declaration. It was issued 2 weeks later, end quote. So Richmond writes, and he further cites Nachum Goldman of the World Zionist Organization as reflecting that when it came to the Balfour Declaration, were it not for Brandeis, it would, quote, probably never have been issued, end quote. This is, I believe, a providential moment from Louis Dembitz to Louis Brandeis to the Balfour Declaration another incredible event in the story that we tell, a story whose miraculous nature is embodied by Jerusalem itself. This is Mayor Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow, signing off.